This is On Target St. John's. A look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Good afternoon, everyone. Well, oil prices are on the rise, but everybody knows the oil industry took a significant turn last year, in part due to the pandemic, which resulted in a drop in global consumption. Couple that with plummeting oil prices, it's meant a major impact on the local oil and gas sector, with thousands of layoffs and real concerns about whether or not the potential in the offshore can ever be realized. In the global backdrop as well is a real push towards a greener economy and a movement away from non-renewable resources. Well, here to discuss what's happening or not happening in the offshore is oil industry consultant Rob Strong. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Linda. Good afternoon to you.
So what is the current situation as it relates to production in the Newfoundland and Labrador offshore?
Well, according to the Canada Newfoundland Offshore Petroleum Board website, which I looked at today, we're doing about 285,000 barrels of oil a day from Hibernia, Hebron, White Rose, and North Amethyst. Obviously, nothing from Terra Nova. The big producer these days is the Hebron field, and its production, and these are November or December figures, the most recent ones that the board posts, it produced about 146,000 barrels of oil a day, followed by Hibernia at 116, and then we dribble down to White Rose at 20,000 and North Amethyst at 4,000. So we're doing 285,000 barrels of oil a day.
How does that compare to, let's say, 3-4 years ago?
Well, of course, Hibernia was at its peak, producing a lot more than 116,000 barrels, and we had Terra Nova. I don't have the figures, but it's down significantly, obviously, if you take Terra Nova out of it, and I think Terra Nova was probably doing, and I'm guessing here, 80,000-90,000 barrels, so it's down significantly over when everything was going full tilt, as we say.
So what's the value in terms of revenue to the province from that kind of level of production? What does it mean?
Well, it's hard to calculate. As, of course, oil prices fluctuate. For instance, Brent today, it's $65.86. I sound just like Brian Medora, by the way. $65.86. My understanding from the last time I looked, royalties contributed about $800 or $900 million, but that was when oil prices were about $40 a barrel. So I would say they're probably over $1 billion. I'm sure Department of Finance would give you a more accurate figure, but that's my guess.
So that's not the only impact on provincial coffers, of course, the production side of things, but exploration is a big part of it as well. What's going on with exploration right now?
Nothing. And that's the sad thing, Linda. Next exploration we hope to see will be in July by this company called CNOOC, which is the China National Oil Company. They're bringing over a rig called the Stena Ice Max. Actually, they're not bringing it over. That rig is currently in Guyana, but when it finishes well in Guyana, it's coming up here. And it's going to drill in the Flemish Pass. But that's the only exploration activity that we can anticipate next year, which is very sad. Particularly sad when you consider that the government of Canada did commit, I think it was $320 million, and everybody in Newfoundland, the NOIA, the governments of Newfoundland, Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, and most of us in the private sector were hoping some of that money would go into encouraging exploration. You need to explore to find oil fields before you can produce and therefore generate revenue. But none of the money to date has gone into exploration at all. And I think that's sad. I think that the government of Newfoundland should have reacted and said to the federal government, why aren't we putting this money in exploration? But politics being what they are, nothing was said, and we've obviously happy to accept the $320 million. But, as I say, it's very sad that none of them went into exploration because we need to find some new fields.
So what are some of the factors involved in this presumed dry up in exploration activity? What's led to that? Is it all entirely decisions made by the operators themselves because it's not economically viable at this time, or are there other factors involved?
Oh, there are dozens of factors, but you're spot on. The initial, I mean, when you consider that the oil industry generally has lost so much money last year, ExxonMobil in particular has recorded the loss of $22 billion, and then Shell and BP, the other two big players, incurred losses of $20 billion. So money is not as flush. Money is not available. Secondly, there are other areas in the world to drill, and I've been preaching Guyana for years. Guyana's CapEx and OPEX, or the capital cost and the operating cost, is somewhere between $23 and $28 per barrel, and that's cheap. And it's cheap because it's a very benign environment. Obviously, they have no icebergs in South America. It's reasonably close to land. It's a less commerce and regulatory authority. And it's one hell of a reservoir. They're talking about 9 billion barrels recoverable. So if you're an oil company, where are you going to put your money? You're going to put your money where you get your best return. It's a basic business decision that any business would do. So the money, the exploration money, what little bit there is out there, is going into jurisdictions whereby they can get the best return. Having said that, it's interesting because I've just been reading up on Norway, and Norway came out with some phenomenal tax concessions, relief for exploration, and just last month they approved 61 new offshore oil and gas licenses. So it just goes to show you that with some incentive, which Norway gave to their operator, you can indeed get some activity. But we have nothing. We in Canada have decided that, or the people in Ottawa have decided that perhaps fossil fuels is not where we want to go, and yet there's going to be a demand for another 40 years. So, as I say, I'm very disappointed in the lack of comment, the lack of. I mean, everybody in the business understands that we need exploration. We need exploration. We don't need to fix up old platforms. We need new fields, and yet there's not a cent of that federal government money gone into that.
You mentioned the relatively benign climate or ocean conditions offshore Guyana, but what about the geographic features, let's say? Is it as deep a water as we are facing here in the offshore?
Yeah, even deeper. There's some 1,500, 1,800 meters of water depth in Guyana. And, you know, and Brazil as well. I mean, Brazil, Guyana, and now Suriname are globally perhaps the, literally and figuratively, the hot spots to be because of the success. They've had 18 discoveries out of 21 wells in Guyana. They had no production, they had no discovery till 2015. In 2020, they're producing 120,000 barrels. By 2025, they will be producing 700,000 barrels of light sweet, much like our crude, oil. So that's what we have to compete against. And that's why we need these incentives. We need something to help the oil companies, believe it or not, to help the oil companies find some new discoveries. And we need big discoveries. We need elephants, elephants being 500 million barrels plus. We need more Hibernias and Hebrons.
The perception, of course, is that why would you give these big oil companies, which a lot of people perceive as being, you know, making a good dollar, federal money? What is the reality there?
Well, if we want to stimulate exploratory activity, we have to do it. Are we going to let somewhere else in the world take advantage of the remaining 30, 40 years of oil demand? Yes, renewables, sure. I mean, if you look at Equinor, which is active offshore Newfoundland. Equinor and BP have just committed $1 billion each to put into renewables off 35 miles off the coast of New York. So people are, oil companies are putting their money in renewables, but it's going to be a long time before your plastics, your cell phone, can be made from either wind power or solar. So there still is a big demand for oil. And my argument is, let's take advantage of this next 30, 40 years and get producing oil.
My guest today on Target is oil industry consultant Rob Strong. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today on Target is Rob Strong. He's an oil industry consultant. We've been talking about what's happening, or in some cases not happening, in the Newfoundland offshore. So what's going on with seismic activity, and what kind of a role does that play in helping to secure future development?
Big role. Thank God. Thank goodness. Nalcor has, for the last, probably 8 or 10 years, been coordinating quite an extensive seismic, and that really gives oil companies an understanding of what the source, well, I'll call it source rock, what the geology looks like, and they have spent roughly $20 million a year for the last 7 or 8 years, and I understand they will be doing it again on shooting seismic from the tip of Labrador up around Seglac right down to the St. Pierre Basin. And that gives the oil companies, when these lands come up for bid, that gives the oil companies an understanding of what the source rock looks like, what the geology looks like. I'm not a geologist, and I'm sure there are some technical terms there, but it's nice to have this advanced information when you're bidding on blocks of acreage. And some of that seismic in the past has given some great indications. There is a block of acreage in what we call the Orphan Basin, which is really just northwest of the Jeanne d'Arc Basin, where Hibernia is, the Hebrons, the White Roses. There's a block of acreage there which is owned by BP, or at least BP has the rights. And the seismic, and I say this with the conditions attached, the seismic indicates that the potential is as big as the whole Jeanne d'Arc Basin. So if you consider all those fields I just mentioned, Hibernia, Hebron, Turnova, and what they've produced, and now all of a sudden there is another geological area that could be as big as that, that's what comes about as a result of seismic. Now, obviously, you have to drill it. There's no guarantee that the seismic is perfect, but certainly it's a good indication. So I'm encouraged to hear that there will be another seismic program this year, and that, of course, will help stimulate, hopefully, some exploration activity.
So if one leads to the other, why aren't we seeing more exploration? Is it purely economic?
Purely economic. Price of oil is, the Saudi Arabia and Russia, ongoing battles over quotas and quantities they're allowed to produce. COVID's been a big restriction. For instance, the Chinese were supposed to be here last year drilling out in the Flemish Pass, and they had to cancel because of COVID. So it's a variety of factors. When oil was $35 a barrel, that was a factor, and COVID was a factor. So, there's a variety of factors. And lots of other places in the world to drill.
What projects are currently on hold?
Well, Bay du Nord is the one that everybody is watching. Bay du Nord is out in the Flemish Pass in deep water, beyond the 200 mile limit. Equinor, who is a world class operator, formerly Statoil from Norway, and I have nothing but great things to say about Equinor as being a classy operator. Equinor has talked about, to date, finding 300 million barrels of recoverable, but that was prior to two wells that they drilled last year. They had two apparently successful wells, and they don't announce the results of these wells, of course, because there's there's acreage surrounding it that may come up for bid, and you don't want your competition knowing what you've got. But the rumor mill has it they had two successful wells, and I'm assuming that they're trying to interpret the results of these two wells into the what we call the Beta Nord Core area, and hopefully make a decision to sanction the project in the near future. And that's a big project, by the way. I mean, it's going to be obviously an FPSO, a floater. It's CapEx. You know, they're talking about $10 billion in capital and operating. It's going to have a 20-year life. It's a high-tech. But what's also interesting, Linda, is for when you get an FPSO, you must remember that all the wells have to be pre-drilled. FPSOs don't drill wells. FPSOs produce oil. So if indeed they sanction it, then we're going to see additional drilling activity in the Flemish Pass. So we've all got our fingers crossed, our toes crossed, that Equinor will hopefully, and you and I, by the way, you and I as taxpayers and as citizens of the province have a 10% equity in that field, or have the right to earn a 10% equity. So it's very important for many reasons. That's what's on the horizon.
So what's the likelihood that these projects will resume or get underway?
I would be on a beach in Florida if I could predict that. I don't know. I can't answer it. Sorry. You'll have to put it to Equinor or in the case of Hibernia, there's potential for what we call subsea tiebacks. In the case of Husky, of course, Husky doesn't exist anymore. Husky is Cenovus. Only they can answer the questions because they have all the statistical information in front of them.
And what's the deal with the Terra Nova right now?
Sad, sitting at Bull Arm. Government of out of that $320 million, I think the governments have committed up to $175 million to help with the upgrade. Upon a guarantee that they will go back into production, but COVID, I understand, is the factor that's prohibiting work on the Terra Nova FPSO. But $175 million. It was originally going to Spain, as people will remember, and again COVID stepped in there, and the Spanish shipyard said no, we are shutting down. So it's parked right now at Bull Arm. It's got a potential commitment of $175 million to do most of the upgrades that can be done here in Newfoundland, which would have been done in Spain. But as I say, as a result of COVID, my understanding is there's nothing going on with it. And of course, obviously the lack of production is having a factor as well. But you can't produce it from Bull Arm.
Any other rigs that have moved off the offshore and have gone elsewhere?
Yeah, the Transocean Barents, which was a fifth or sixth generation semi-submersible, was drilled the two wells for Equinor. It was at Bull Arm for a little period of time, but it's now gone to Norway, and it's what we call warm stacked. It had to have some surveys and some work done on it, so it's sitting in Norway. And we were hoping that it would come back to Newfoundland and look at either that BP acreage that I spoke of or another company called BHP that were supposed to drill in 2022, but for some reason or other they have announced now there will be no drilling by BHP or BP in 2022. So the rig is sitting idle right now in Norway. The Henry Goodridge, the old workhorse, the 25 or 30-year-old rig, that's at Bull Arm right now, as is the Seadrill West Aquarius. But nowhere else to go in the world.
Once these assets move out of the region, and I've heard Noya say this, Charlene Johnson has said it numerous times, once these rigs move out, it's very unlikely to get them back. Is that your experience or opinion?
Yes, mobilizing I mean, these rigs are even in today's depressed rig markets, these rigs are $300,000 a day plus. So if you've got to haul it from Brazil or West Africa or the North Sea, bang, that's another 15 days. So, you know, $4 or $5 million just to get it here. And if the program's only a one well program, then you got to move it out of here after the well is over. So, you know, you add $6, $7, $8 million to just mobilization and demobilization costs, it's hard to get back.
My guest today on Target is oil industry consultant Rob Strong. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're talking to Rob Strong, oil industry consultant who has a long history in the Newfoundland offshore. You were in the very early days of the Atlantic Accord and all that.
I was very, very fortunate to get involved in 79 in the heyday of the petroleum incentive grants and thousands of jobs for hundreds of Newfoundlanders. And luckily enough, I've had 42 years involvement ever since. So yeah, been a great career, Linda. And even at my old age, I have no intention of retiring. It's too exciting. And if I can't do things around here, I can certainly go back to Guyana, where I've been 7 times, and follow activities down there. So yeah, it's been a hell of a ride, and I ain't finished yet.
Good to hear. So what about this funding that was announced before Christmas? Is the $240 million anywhere near the amount needed to secure jobs that were lost?
Well, you know, you guys carry the stories when the Husky announcement was made, and Husky got, I think, $41 million of that money, and then laid off people the next day. I don't really know what's going on with the other Husky activities. Argentia, as we all know, is building the concrete structure, the CGS. Marystown are doing the accommodation module. And the big module, the whole topside, is being built by Kiewit in Ingleside, Texas. I'd be curious to know, actually. I must make some calls. Or maybe your newsroom can make some calls and see what's happening down there. But there's very little happening in Argentia, and there's very little happening in Marystown. And part of that, of course, is COVID-related, so you can't just arbitrarily say there's nothing going on. There are some factors that influence the amount of activity. Hibernia was awarded, I think it was $38 million, and that was to enhance their drilling capabilities. And a good thing there, in so much as that it looks, according to the Hibernia press release at the time, it says it could extend the life of the field for an additional 10 years. So Hibernia has been a real good producer, and any support that we can give to continue. We do know that they've extended the life of the platform till 2040, so we got 20 more years or 18 more years of potential production coming from Hibernia, and there are lots of smaller pockets of oil within reach of Hibernia, thus the word subsea tieback. Hibernia has done one already. But when they got approval to do the first one, they sought approval to do 5 more. So we do anticipate, as the main reservoir gets depleted, if there's a couple hundred million barrels close by could be 10, 15 kilometers, they can easily tap into that and run it back to the platform. You don't need the capital expenditure of a new platform when you can tie it back to an existing platform, which has surplus capacity. So Hibernia has gotten $41 million. I think White Rose has gotten, Hibernia's gotten $38 million. White Rose got $41 million. And Terra Nova has got $175 million. But no money of that, none of that's been spent. But again, I go back to what I said earlier. I, for one, would have liked to have seen that money spent to encourage more exploration. And I can't tell you how disappointed I am that we, as a province, stood by and didn't argue with the feds and say, look, guys, we need this money for exploration. We need new finds. We don't need to be fixing up old rigs. But politics being what they are, it's not my call. But if it was, boy, I'd be banging on Ottawa's desk saying, come on, support this industry. We have good potential. We have light sweet crude. We have a trained workforce. Why aren't you helping us find new oil fields? But I'm not a politician.
But is the political will there at all? You know,
I don't
on any
think
front?
So. I don't think the federal. I think the federal government is trying to stay away as much as they can from fossil fuel. They have to realize that fossil fuels, oil in particular, are going to be around for the next 30, 40 years. Yes, we're switching to solar. Yes, we're switching to wind. Yes, we're switching to hydrogen. Yes, we're switching to ammonia. But you still need oil for petrochemical feedstock for your plastics and your plastic bottles, your cell phones, your components in your car, your television. There are a whole raft of products besides burning it in a diesel engine. So there's still going to be a big demand for oil, and the federal government has to realize that, you know.
So who or what are the biggest, you're sort of hinting at it there, but who or what are the biggest consumers of oil and oil products? Is it mainly fuel or is it
yeah,
products?
Yeah, it's fuel, it's diesel, I think about 60%, and the other 40% is feedstock for a variety of products. So where's that 40% going to come from? As I say, you can't make a cell phone out of wind power, or you can't fly an airplane from solar. You may in 30, 40 years, but what are you going to do in the short term?
So the price of oil is currently on the rise. What's happening there?
Well, 65. Ask your Brian Medora. He gets all excited about that. Last time I looked, it was 65.86. Supply and demand. The demand excuse me, Linda. Let me turn that off. Supply and demand is as we come out of COVID, as the U.S. economy starts to ramp up, as China begins to expand, as India begins to expand, demand is increasing. So when you have a increase in demand, you normally have an increase in price. So that's driving it somewhat. The members of OPEC seem to have, although there's a meeting on the 6th of March, which should give us some further direction as to, you have to remember, OPEC with its 12 or 14 members control about 25% of the globe. The world produces about 100 million barrels of oil a day, normally. Prior to COVID, 100 million. Today, 92 million. So we're down 8 or 10 million. We're down 8 or 10 million barrels. But as COVID, cure COVID, or at least we wrestle COVID, economies are going to boom, and we're going to be back up to 100 million barrels of oil a day. And oil companies haven't been spending money. So, as I say, supply and demand, in this case the demand, is exceeding the supply, so therefore the price goes up.
So with these rising oil prices, is that good news? Could it mean a quicker resumption in production and exploration in the Newfoundland offshore?
Got my fingers and toes crossed. Yes, 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 hopefully. I mean, we know the reserves are out there. We know the seismic looks good. Hibernia has been once described as a jewel in the Exxon crown. So we know that the source rock is there. Hopefully, with $65 a barrel, we'll see some more activity. Not less, which is, of course, what's happened when we were down to $40 a barrel. How long oil is going to stay up to 65? I've seen estimates up to as high as $100 a barrel, and estimates as low as $40 a barrel. So it's anybody's guess.
And again, those crystal balls aren't always readily available to us, either in this business or in yours.
Certainly not. Wish they were.
My guest today on Target is oil industry consultant Rob Strong. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And my guest today is oil industry consultant Rob Strong, who's a big fan, by the sounds of it, of Brian Madour.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of VOCM.
Well, that's good to hear.
I have my screen, my computer on, and I'm looking at live at 2 p.m. for the COVID update, as I watch every day. And I'm delighted and want to thank VOCM for the great job they're doing in covering this COVID. I wouldn't miss it. I listen in every day for it.
Absolutely, as a lot of people do. So what about the long-term viability of oil in this global push towards a greener economy?
I keep saying that we've got 40, 50 years of potential fossil fuel production for all the reasons I've talked about. Yes, we're switching to other renewables. You know, and particularly wind, Linda. I was talking about this wind farm down in the United States, let me just read one sentence. The commitment of New York, along with other northeastern states, will lead to a total of 23.3 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2035. A gigawatt is 1,000 megawatts. So if you talk about Muskrat at being 700 megawatts, and you talk about Upper Churchill at 5,000 megawatts, just think that the potential in the northeastern United States for wind power is 23.3 gigawatts. So yes, the renewables are coming on. Natural gas is coming on as well. LNG is particularly becoming big because it's a lot more friendly vis-a-vis greenhouse gases. It's easy to transport. Shipping companies are converting to LNG every day. So natural gas, you know, LNG comes from obviously liquid natural gas. So when we have some gas deposits off Newfoundland, which I'd love to see somebody pay some attention to. So as for long-term potential, I mean, there will always be a demand for oil in some form or another. How big that demand will be, it will depend upon how successful we are as a global society in coming up with renewables that are less harmful to the environment. And everybody wants that, obviously.
In the end, I guess consumer demand is what pushes this all, ultimately. And I notice more mainstream auto manufacturers are responding to the demand for electric vehicles. What kind of an impact does that have on the oil sector?
So obviously a big one, or will have a big one. You notice some of the advertisements on television these days talk about going all electric in years to come. But again, there are other demands, other needs, other uses for oil than in an engine. So yeah, sure, the demand's going to go down, but it's never going to disappear.
And how are operators adjusting to, you know, this consciousness, if you will?
Everybody and their dog. Sorry, every oil company in the world is looking at how they can utilize their existing skills into renewables. As I say, this field offshore near this wind farm offshore New York is Equinor and BP, two of the largest oil companies in the world. So they're adjusting to it. They want to be in the business of generating power, whether it's from oil, whether it's from wind, whether it's from solar, whether it's from hydrogen, whether it's from whatever. So they're in the business of producing power, whether it's by oil or whatever.
Who's more responsive than the rest, I guess, if you will? Who's ahead of the curve there?
I would say BP globally. For instance, BP's offshore exploration department globally used to have 700 people in it. Today it has 100 people in it. BP is probably the greenest of the green. I would say Equinor because of their coming from Norway, and Norway is a I've been lucky enough to be in Norway 20 or 30 times in my working career, and it's a very, very green, environmentally sensitive country. So I'd say Equinor is the second one, but you've got Total, you've got Shell, you've got Petronas, you've got Petrobras. All oil companies are now looking at renewables, primarily wind at this stage, because some of the skills that they have are transferable, whether you design in a gravity-based system for a topside, or you design a gravity-based system for a wind turbine. Some of the skills are the same. So these oil companies have these skills. Why not put them to work on renewables?
I know you don't like that crystal ball because you'd be on a beach somewhere if you did have that. But you've been around a long time. You've seen the trends. I know that we're in some pretty extraordinary circumstances now, not typically seen before. But what are your predictions? Where do you see this going in the next 10, 15, 20 years?
You always save the hardest questions for the last. And I know you've got a break soon for COVID, so I'm going to talk around the answer. How do I say, Linda? From a Newfoundland perspective, I'm concerned because, of course, our costs are fairly high because we're so far away from land, and because we have ice and wind, and we're on now 200 miles. So I am concerned about the long-term future for oil and gas in Newfoundland. Globally, if you can produce oil at $22 a barrel and do it responsibly, if you can re-inject those carbons, the carbon dioxides and the carbon monoxides, and re-inject that down into the reservoir so it doesn't get into the environment, and you can produce oil at $20 a barrel, I think the future is fairly bright. So there are, I don't know if I answered your question or not. Maybe it is bright, maybe it isn't.
What's your message then to people who, have been laid off since all of this took a turn?
As our friend Janice would say, hold fast. Hold fast, Newfoundland. There is, Hibernia is good for another 20 years. I'd say Hebron is good for another 20 years. If Equinor gets Bay du Nord going, that's good for 20 years. We get another field or two going. It's certainly not going to be the heyday when we had 4 and 5 semi-submersible rigs out there drilling, but it's still going to play a significant role in the Newfoundland economy.
And what kind of opportunities are available to people who have been displaced by the downturn? Are their skills transferable?
Well, unfortunately not in Newfoundland. I mean, and of course not in Canada. When you think about, at one stage, I think we used to have 15,000-20,000 Newfoundlanders working out west. Out west, employment has dried up. But the new technology, digitalization, running this new Bay du Nord, if and when it happens, is primarily going to be run from onshore. So there's a whole new set of skills required to run a platform from onshore versus offshore. Computerization, electrification of offshore fields. So if you've got some basic skills, I'm assuming you must be able to adapt those skills to the new environment. And the new environment is much more technical. The old days of roustabouts and roughnecks and guys slugging pipe around, most of that now is automated. So you've got to adjust to the realities of the 2020s.
Rob Strong, I do appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you very much.
And thank you. And for all you guys at VOCM, thank you very much, and be safe.
Indeed. Same to you. Thanks for listening.